Hello.
Hola.
Welcome back to Double Indemnity, the podcast where me and my husband like to talk about new movies and discuss movie releases, and we watch them and we review them, and we don't know what we're talking about because we're not professionals, but...
I kind of know what I'm talking about. Yes. I have a minor in film studies.
He does. He does.
I do.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. We had a little bit of a hiatus. We got married and pre-filmed a bunch of episodes, which was a lot. And then I was traveling like all of October for work and then to see my family and right after getting back from the wedding. So just, you know, excuses. Basically, we just kind of wanted a little bit of a break.
Yeah.
But we're back now. I'm not going to lie. All of the movies that were coming out in October, I like wasn't that excited for anyways.
There weren't really a whole lot.
Yeah. But November, there's like a lot of stuff coming out that I'm like really excited to talk about on the podcast. So I'm feeling hyped. I'm ready.
There's a bunch of stuff in November.
Yeah. I'm really excited to be back and better than ever. You know what they say. Live, love, laugh.
Laugh, love, live.
What's the middle one? Live, love. Love, love, live, laugh. I really have to think about like how I mix it up.
Live, love, live.
What? Okay.
There's no laugh.
So be prepared for lots of spoilers. We're going to talk about the whole movie. And also, if you want to follow us on Letterboxd, DI_podcast, we post the movies there before we talk about them. So first segment of the podcast, what are we watching right now?
I'm looking at Letterboxd, and your sister, Carly, gave Prisoners a 2.5 stars.
What's Prisoners?
Prisoners?
What is it?
A mystery movie? I can't believe she gave it a 2.5 stars.
Oh my gosh. Carly, I know Carly's the only person who listens to this. I could not finish that movie. I thought it was so hard to watch. Did she write a review?
No.
I agree with her. 2.5 stars. It wasn't even
finishable.
It's
a 5-star movie. That's one of the best mysteries I've ever seen.
What was the, like, wasn't that the two men who, like, the girl went missing and they blamed this one guy and then they took him captive.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the ending? Anybody who wants to not know the ending, like skip forward a little bit because
I
want
to
know.
Tell you,
I'm never going
to
watch it.
Experience it.
I'm
again.
Never going to watch it.
I can't tell you.
Oh my God.
Wouldn't do it justice.
I guess it's just like Game of Thrones. I was like, I will never watch this. Yeah. And now it's like one of my favorite shows. But I can already tell you right now, I will not like Prisoners because I've seen more than 50% of the movie. With Game of Thrones, I had only seen the first season, which wasn't 50% of Game of Thrones content. And truly, if you are out there and you are not into Game of Thrones, watch House of Dragon first, because that will hook you. And then once you're into the Game of Thrones universe, you're like golden for the rest of to watch Game of Thrones.
You have to go House of Dragon first, but
no, but if you're somebody who say like wasn't interested in it at first, like I'm not a fantasy person. It doesn't call to me, you know?
No.
Not like a rom-com.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you don't really like, we're watching Lord of the Rings right now, and she doesn't really seem, you don't seem to be into it.
Honestly, I'm like, the only thing about it that I'm really enjoying is it reminds me of last winter when we were just hermit crabs and we watched all of Game of Thrones. And this is like my way of reenacting that, but with the Lord of the Rings. And I'm enjoying it. It's just not as like, I don't know, Game of Thrones is just awesome. This is like, oh, there's another bad guy. Ooh, there's like a scary thing. We'll beat it, then we move on, you know?
Yeah.
Nobody dies. There's so much plot armor in Lord of the Rings.
I actually honestly didn't realize how much plot armor there is until this time around.
It's so painful, and that's what makes Game of Thrones so good, and that's what you told me when we first watched it, is there's no plot armor.
I do remember
and
saying that.
You were
that.
Right. It was a very accurate statement.
Yeah.
Yes. Well stated.
The accuracy cannot be denied.
Yeah.
What else have we been watching?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we've been watching Lord of the Rings.
These are all old though. This isn't recent.
We haven't been watching much recently.
I guess that's true.
Yeah. We'll just say Lord of the Rings and leave it at that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to enter the movie?
Yep. It is Killers of the Flower Moon.
Whoop whoop.
Really cool title, by the way.
Loved the title. It was great. I'm not going to lie though. I was not looking forward to this movie. I thought it was going to be really boring.
Yeah.
Because normally when like with these big directors who've been around for like decades, like you kind of just like assume the like majority of the movie is just going to be like these scenes of people contemplating life in silence. You know what I mean? Like, as if somehow that makes the movie profound. Like, ooh, this person sits and thinks. And you had a good argument for it, because, like, you said that's what life is like. People just sit and think. But, like, I go to the movies to not experience my life. I go to experience other people's lives.
Yeah.
And he did a very good job of not doing that in this movie. It was not just, like, contemplation station, you know?
Yeah.
Gosh, like, isn't that what Nomadland was? Was just contemplation the whole time?
Okay, yes, but I still really like Nomadland.
Although I haven't I've seen it, so I'm not going to speak badly of it because I haven't seen it, but that movie got so much recognition, and all I heard about it was that it was like a contemplation movie.
It's just like a slice of life movie, if you will.
A slice of life.
Yes.
That's a really sweet way to say it. I've never heard that before.
Really?
Yeah. Well, that's so cute.
I just coined it right now.
Pie has like a very good connotation, so like a slice of life.
Slice of pie.
That's so cute.
Thanks.
I love that. Okay, carry on with your intro.
Of course, directed by Martin Scorsese, one of the best filmmakers ever, pretty much. He's already solidified that, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Would you agree?
Oh, he's like a well-known name amongst people who don't even like, aren't even into like movies and cinema. Everybody's heard his name before.
Yeah, especially because his daughter is on TikTok now, and then he's on TikTok with her.
Is she TikTok famous or something?
I don't know about famous, but she's on it. I don't really know, actually.
So wait, what does he do on TikTok?
Just like, I don't even know.
Does he just like make him do funny videos and stuff?
Yeah.
That's so cute.
It's very cute.
I love that.
Stars the man himself, Leonardo DiCaprio, in his first role since, what was his last movie? Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, right?
That would make sense.
2019, yeah. As Ernest Burkhart.
He took a COVID hiatus. A lot of people did.
That's true. I don't blame it. Lily Gladstone as Molly Burkhart, who was excellent. I mean, everybody's excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Robert De Niro as William K. Hale, kind of the bad guy who's dressed up as a good guy of the town.
Mm-hmm.
And then good old Jesse Plemons as Tom White. I love him.
He's so good. I love that they didn't make him out to be like, I don't want to say like a creepo, but they usually make him out to be like the weird guy.
Yeah.
And this time he was just like, he was just the cop, and he did a great job. Yeah. Like, I loved it. And also something really funny about Molly's character is like, the second I saw the commercial, okay, first off, I loved her in this role. I thought she was perfectly casted. She was literally amazing. She had this like wise quietness to her,
mm-hmm.
and like her just like facial acting was so good. You know what I mean? Like, overall, loved her. But I just, the first thing that I thought when I saw the ad was like, it didn't seem believable to me because Leonardo DiCaprio is so stereotypically someone who only dates women under 25, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just like, it's funny watching him like do this movie where he is like madly in love with this woman that like you could never imagine them being together in real life because of his like widely known standard of women.
Yes, yes.
But
yeah, I thought that was funny too.
I mean, they were great together.
I know. Yeah,
they really did make a good couple.
Fun fact about Lily Gladstone. So she's been in some other movies, but during, it was COVID, she was gonna do like a change of careers because there really wasn't a whole lot of opportunities for her, and she was contacted by Martin Scorsese, and he was just like, I want you to be in this movie. Didn't even have to audition.
Wow, that's so cool.
Just had like a Zoom call.
She was perfect for it.
Yeah,
I loved it. And I also think something interesting about Leonardo DiCaprio is he, you know how most actors play themselves. Like, this most stereotypical example is Tom Hanks, right?
Yeah.
With Leonardo DiCaprio, he always plays the same character, but in such a different way. Like, he always, like, he, in Inception, right? He's like the hot shot. He knows everything. He's like this highly talented, skilled person.
Yeah.
But then in this movie, Killers of the Flower Moon, he's kind of considered like the stupidest guy in town. Like, he doesn't know what he's doing. He's just trying to like make people happy because he thinks that will give him, like, that will lead him to success without considering the consequences of what people are asking him. But like, somehow his mannerisms and everything are the same at the same time. Like, it just doesn't even make any sense. Like, he's somehow playing the same character, but he puts this spin on it that it's so different and it's so unique every time. Like, I really think he is like a fantastic actor.
Yeah, me too. Like, he doesn't, like, you still see Leonardo DiCaprio, but that doesn't really bother me.
Yes.
Like, if that makes sense. Yeah. Because, like Daniel Day-Lewis disappears and method acting and Hibba Jibba, all that argument, whether it's better or worse for acting. But, yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio just hits it out of the park every time. I don't really think he method acts, no.
I don't know. Like, it's kind of similar to me to, like, Joaquin Phoenix, that he is so Joaquin Phoenix. Like, you see him and it is just like you just know it's him. You know what I mean? Like, just how it is with like those huge actors. But he just, like, perfects it, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, he is just so immersed in what he's doing that it's so real. I don't know. Leonardo DiCaprio, like, he's at that point. He's pretty legit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's great. The plot, when oil is discovered in the 1920s, Oklahoma, under Osage Nation land, the Osage people are murdered one by one until the FBI steps in to unravel the mystery. Budget?
150.
200.
I guess I lowballed it. It's Martin, so I was like, oh, a little bit higher.
Martin.
Beans, what do you want?
box office, it has made $120 million worldwide.
That's good.
Yeah, it's better than I thought it was going to do, actually.
Really?
Yeah. What was I going to say?
Do you think it'll win any Oscars?
Yes.
What for?
I think it'll be nominated for at least like 7 or 8.
Mm-hmm. 7 or 8.
Yeah. Wow. Best actor, best actress.
Cinematography,
sound design, score.
Maybe supporting roles.
Supporting. Yeah.
Did a lot, just a lot.
Yes. Yeah.
I loved it.
And yeah, it's 4.5 stars for me.
Me too. 4.5. We agreed. Twins. Yeah.
Nice.
Usually you're like a little bit higher on these kinds of like artistry crafted movies.
Artur.
You're
movies.
Usually rate higher on the artistic movies and I rate higher on like the cutesy movies than you do.
That's true.
But we agreed on this one. Okay. Let's go into our notes a little bit before we get into the plot, if you're ready.
Yes, I did want to mention, this is the best performance by Robert De Niro I've seen in a long time.
Really? Why do you say that?
Yeah. Well, actually, well, you know, he was great in The Irishman, too. Fine, best performance I've seen in him since The Irishman. I kind of forgot about that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was great. He was great. I feel like he could have easily been casted as the bad guy in Oppenheimer, but I'm glad that they didn't.
As the bad guy?
Licking me beans. Okay, what? I need a second so that I can get beans settled. You know, in Oppenheimer, whoever, who played Robert, whatever his name is.
Oh, Robert Downey Jr.
Robert Downey Jr., yeah.
Strauss.
He could have played Strauss. Beans, you want to sit here? No? I don't know what you want, love. Okay, so let's get into the notes. I think that they did such a good job in this movie of the character development, like the way that they wrote it. It didn't feel like they were handing you parts of their story at the beginning to develop very specific traits just to like make the story easy. Because that's what a lot of like movies will just do. They'll be like, oh, throw this background story about, oh, this girl's mom died or something. And then they throw it in there as if it's going to develop the character.
Make you care.
Exponentially to where you care about them. In this movie, it's like, you feel like extremely intertwined in their lives, and like instead of just feeling sad for them or happy for them, like you feel like the physical experience of the weight of their emotions, like on you. Like you feel heavy watching it because
it's a heavy movie.
Yes, it's really intense topics, and it's like it's almost like they twist it into kind of like a true crime story at the end because it's so almost fantastical that it's hard to believe that it's real.
Yeah.
But then they do such a good job at not making it into like this like cinematic experience of watching it. They make it into a like
a learning experience. Maybe.
Yes. Like understanding the tragedy of watching it, you know?
Yeah. Without glorifying or calling too much attention to itself.
True. And they don't turn anybody into a hero into it either. Like a lot of true crime things will like martyr the people like who went through it, when in reality they just showed like these are good people living their lives and these terrible things happen to them, you know? Like it's just, I really liked how they portrayed the characters, and it was very like well crafted and written,
Yeah.
I think that's why, like, you don't get bored in it. It's 3.5 hours long. I didn't get bored.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen 2.5 hour long movies that felt so much longer than this movie.
Yeah. I felt like every scene, like, was intentional, you know? And I really loved how, like, Scorsese would, like, in the middle of intense scenes of conflict, like people arguing or something like really intense in the storyline happening, he would cut to the, like, whatever the community was experiencing at the same time, like back and forth they would go through it, and it's like you would not only feel the spiraling feeling of like the characters' arguments or emotions or like whatever was happening, but you would also feel the overwhelming sense of like how those characters would be feeling because of the daily stressors of like what they were experiencing compiling into like the argument. I thought it was so cool. That's I really liked it. Yeah.
I liked them. Good note. I thought I was going to get kind of bored, honestly, and I didn't. I enjoyed this probably definitely more than The Irishman, I think, and it's 30 minutes longer.
It's so good. And I remember when we were walking in, the manager of the movie theater here, we love her. She's so sweet. And just nice. Like, she is like a lover of movies. Like, every time you come in, she's seen every movie. The second it comes to the theater, she sees it. And I just love that. Because I feel like sometimes at the movies, the employees, you know, it's like a hard part-time job. It is not a fun experience, I feel like, to work at a movie theater.
No, I doubt it.
And so you're normally met with people who are like, exhausted, you know what I mean? And she was just like, she's always a pleasant spirit at the movies, and I love her. But she told us, she's like, oh, a good time to stand up and walk around if you need to stretch your legs or you're like bored is during the court scene. And I remember getting to the court scene and I was like, I can't leave, I don't want to miss anything. The thing about movies like that is like you miss one line
and it's like,
and well, you're confused, you're just like the whole entire climax of the movie is messed up when you get there, you know what I mean?
Exactly. I was thinking the same thing. I was like, I don't want to leave, I don't have to go to the bathroom. Yeah, but I'm good. Let's just keep going.
Okay, so the movie starts out with a group of Native American community together burying a ceremonial pipe as they mourn their community taking on the culture of American society. So you can see a lot of people are crying and they're distraught about it because a lot of their cultural traditions, they're basically like vocally saying like, we are going to let these traditions die and we're going to morph into like modern society. And people are really upset about it.
I didn't really realize that's what that scene was about.
Yeah, you didn't. That's what he literally said it.
When?
He said, we're giving up our like culture for like the white man, whatever they said that. Yeah, right.
I totally missed that.
Yeah, and then people were crying and the kids were watching like through the openings in the building.
That was a cool shot in that one scene.
Yeah,
it was. I forget what that shot's called. My film minor studies teacher's rolling in their grave right now. Not in their grave, they're not dead. Sorry. That is not what I meant.
They're rolling over in their comfy squishy bed at home where they're happy people.
Exactly.
So they show you many different scenes to kind of like introduce the movie of like rich Osage people being driven around town by private drivers, wearing nice clothes, being waited on by wait staff, and they have maids and they have the nicest houses in town. They have all these jewels and they wear mink. And they're shown as being the high society of the community. And I guess maybe they were trying to go for the shock factor of it with that to kind of like really show you like this is not a community that you would expect to see in like the 1910s, you know. Usually it would, in America, the like luxurious community at that time would be all white people. And you're seeing like Native American population is like high society at the time. So it's a really cool way to enter the movie, and it piques a lot of interest, I feel like, in the audience of like, what is this story? Like, what's, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't seem like something you would normally see. So they explain to you that the Osage community are the richest people per capita at that point in time. And it's because the Osage community stroke oil and were able to maintain control of the land that contained the oil. So that basically made them like millionaires at the time or something. Like they had an obscene amount of money. So they also tell you about the name of the movie, The Flower Moon, and it's basically what they call the fields when they're in bloom, because they talk about how it's like if you sprinkled sugar over the fields or something, yeah, and it would blossom with these beautiful sweet flowers. And so that's where the movie name comes from, which was cute that they kind of like introduced the meaning of the sun and the moon and all of these different things in their culture. So they also introduced the fact that the law requires that white court-appointed guardians manage the money of full and half-blooded members, considering them incompetent. So if you were like a millionaire within the Osage community, you would have your money managed and monitored by like a white banker, basically. And it was crazy. It was like you would have to verify every single purchase that you make and you would have to get it approved, which is just wild that that was real.
It's crazy.
Like these people are literally millionaires and they're still being controlled. Like they found a way to control these people.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was wild.
Shout out to the white man, man. Jeez.
What are you talking about?
Just always manipulating.
Yeah. Okay, so you were then introduced to Ernest Burkhart, who is Leonardo DiCaprio, and he is returning from war to work for his uncle, William King Hale.
My question was, like, World War One ended in, like, 1918.
This took place in about the 20s. It was 20s fashion.
I guess you're right. Yeah, it was 20s. I don't know why I was thinking it was he came back, like, 1926 or something.
No, I thought it was in, like, the late 10s. Yeah. So he's returning from the war. He is going to work for his uncle, William King Hale, who owns a large ranch and seems to have a lot of money in the community. They literally show you, as your introduction to Ernest and to William King Hale, a long conversation between the two of them in King's study, where they basically show you bluntly, like, the characters and their personalities. And they show you that Ernest is a shy man who falls prey easily to momentary desires, but he seeks the approval of powerful people, mm-hmm, basically. And then they show you that King is a man who craves power and knows easily how to manipulate people around him. And just the fact that he calls himself King shows you a lot about how he sees himself as a powerful ruling man in his society, which was interesting. And I really liked the expose of the conversation. It was like a little bit long. That was the only part of the movie where I was like, this is kind of long, but it was very intentional. Like every single sentence they had, you know, like they showed like, oh, he's very derogatory towards women. And he's almost teaching Ernest this. And he's almost asking Ernest, like, do you like women? Like, what are the things about you that I can control? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What are your weak points? And Ernest just crumbles to it.
Yeah. How do I test you and
gain
advantage over you?
Like, Ernest is a grown man. And he is, like, sitting there acting like the child of King. As if, like, he wants to please him and be at his beck and call. And he needs to have the approval of him, you know?
Yeah.
So King speaks very highly of the Osage people in public. He speaks their language. He shows concerns for their ailments and he gives them lots of gifts and contributes a lot of money to their community. So people consider him a friend. He's been doing it for decades on decades. And he suggests to Ernest that maybe he should marry Molly Kyle, who is a local Osage woman that has oil head rights. So she is very
obviously
rich. Means don't chew on the pillow.
Oh, yeah. In the scene when he's flirting with her and he says, oh, that must be Indian for handsome devil. That was ad-libbed by Leonardo DiCaprio.
Really?
Yeah. And Scorsese says that was the moment DiCaprio and Gladstone became a unit as actors.
Really?
Yeah.
It's just like they just like really clicked on each other.
Yeah.
It was a really good ad-lib.
It was good. Guess how much he was paid for this?
The woman?
No, Leonardo DiCaprio.
$10 million?
$30 million.
$30 million.
Isn't that crazy?
Out of a budget, $150 million.
Of 200.
He was paid 15% of the entire film's budget. The entire budget.
That's not including marketing either.
That's crazy.
Highest of his career.
He was amazing. I don't know. When you get to paying people that much money, I'm like, are you really worth that value? But if you make the company that much money, you're stimulating the economy that much, like maybe you are.
I guess that's true. I just wonder what Lily's was compared to
him. How can you look it up?
Yeah, I can.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy. So Ernest likes to spend his free time robbing the Osage women of their jewels and gambling it away. But he still, without shame, is like, yeah, I'm going to pursue Molly and date her. Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me how he would do that. And then the next day try to marry an Osage woman after like disrespecting all of her like community members. But Ernest has been a cab driver for Molly. So that's how he knows her. And he starts to flirt with her. And then that's when he has that line Jonathan was just talking about.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of, I wrote a couple comments here about how like, this is where like you really realize like she has an amazing gaze and like there is so much wisdom in her eyes and she seems to be like an exceptionally smart woman. The way they portray her, she's very quiet, she's very patient, she listens and she like comprehends and calculates before she responds or acts any which way.
Yes.
And it's probably because she, you know, her character would have learned living in a society like that, like you can't say whatever you want, you can't be rude, you can't be disrespectful, you're a woman, you know what I mean? Like at that time period you didn't have much of a voice to speak, and I think you could tell that her character had learned that.
Yeah.
And then was almost like using it to her advantage. And so she appears to know that he isn't the brightest bulb, and it seems that she perceives that as he would never be smart enough to steal all of her money and hurt her. But I don't think she realizes that that could actually make him the means by which her enemies harm her and her family because he's so easy to manipulate.
Yeah, that is.
It's funny because she seems to think it's almost like a good trait about him, and it ends up being like
their downfall.
Yeah, literally. Yeah. I thought it was interesting. Stop, Beans. You have this toy to chew on. She likes to like nibble on fabric, and she is nibbling on her toy, but then decides for a little bit to nibble on my quilt and then to nibble on the pillow.
She looks so cute while she's doing it, though.
She does look really cute while she does it. So the two end up getting married and they seem to be very much in love. King hints in private a lot to Ernest that he plans to kill off all of Molly's family in order to inherit all of their money. And I don't know why, but Ernest just goes along with it. Like he doesn't
cool,
seem
man, let's
like
do
it's
it.
His wife's family. Like
I've
you don't
got
have
no qualms it. About this.
And it, you know, he eventually switches sides and realizes his grandfather's a terrible person, but it's way
Uncle.
Too late. His uncle is like a bad Sorry. Person, but it's way too late. Like he like, needed to come to his senses much earlier.
Yeah. He'd already crossed the Rubicon before
yeah,
then.
He already destroyed his family to the point of no return.
Yeah.
So, background on Molly is she has three sisters, one who is ill. She also has a mother who is ill, and Molly herself has diabetes. So it's a very sick family. And one of Molly's sisters ends up dying of a mysterious illness. And King orders one of his henchmen to kill Molly's oldest sister, Anna, and Molly's mother dies of old age. So that leaves
a lot of death in the family.
Yeah. That leaves two of the five women left, Molly and her sister, Rita. And Molly and Rita are at a point of like extreme paranoia to be like, our family members are dying off. Our community members are dying off unexpectedly. And it's like terrifying. And so Molly is fearful of her life. Rita seems a little bit more relaxed about it, but they don't really tell you much about Rita.
Yeah, that's true. She's usually intoxicated.
Yeah. And something... No, that's Anna. Rita is
oh,
the
Oh, I'm
the
sorry.
Last
Anna. Yeah,
die.
You're right.
Yeah. Something interesting about Rita is that she actually married her dead sister's husband. Why would you do that?
I know, right? I was thinking that, too. I was like...
Why would you do
I was
that?
Like, what?
Yeah. I just didn't get that.
Like, that's like an unspoken rule. You just don't.
Yeah. It seems like her husband, Bill, just like wanted to be in the family. He wanted the money. It's like they were gold digging white husbands, you know?
Yeah.
It's such a reverse thing because like in society, like you consider gold diggers like women, you know?
It's like if you and Landon died, that'd be me marrying Carly.
That is just like unfathomable.
No,
that would
yeah,
never
no.
happen. That is so weird.
I know. Yeah.
That is really weird. Okay. So the Osage Council has come together to discuss all these terrifying murders and disappearances that are happening amongst the people in their community, and they're blaming the white residents, and they plan to start fighting back. So something also happening at the same time is the Tulsa riots, which instills a lot of fear in the Osage people because they're scared something like that is going to happen within their community.
Which is rightfully so.
Yeah. So... kind of a side storyline they go into is Molly's first husband. So she had actually been married to another Osage man but their marriage did not stand the test of time, I guess. They don't really go into the details about why they didn't stay married. But they kind of introduced the fact that Henry is a melancholic, as they called it at the time. But what you deduce basically is that he suffered from like severe depression. And maybe that's the reason their relationship didn't work out. I don't know. But and he's basically like attempted suicide many times, and he's just very sad person, and he doesn't basically want to be alive. It's very sad. And so King pretends to take care of Henry as his best friend, but he actually, you know, just wants to take out a life insurance policy on Henry. Which to me is weird. Why would you take a life insurance policy out on a friend of yours? That's so weird.
I know, right? Yeah.
That's take a life insurance policy out on like anybody that you want?
I don't know.
It doesn't make sense to me why I would do that. But so he then orders the death of his friend Henry so that he can cash in on a life insurance policy. And he tasks Ernest with having to organize it. And he tells him to make it look like a suicide. Now, Ernest's hitman does not do a good job setting up the scene. Ends up looking like a murder instead of a suicide. So
yeah, it was like, there's no way that could look like a suicide.
It was pretty bad. But the way that they told the story of it was like so good. Like the hitman becomes friends with Henry. He doesn't want to kill him. They go to the bar together. It was just like really well written. It was like a fun little side story. Like all the little tangents they went into, instead of like being like annoying and making the movie long, were like interesting and cute.
Interesting,
you know?
And cute.
So King is furious at Ernest for messing it up, and there's this like creepy power dynamic between the two of them, and King literally spanks Ernest as if he's a child. And this is like when you're starting to really realize that Ernest is very easily manipulated by his wife and King, because he just wants them to be pleased with them. Like he doesn't think of the bigger picture of his actions. He only thinks of like the momentary response that he's going to get from whomever he needs validation from.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
So there are no investigations for any of the murders going on in the town. And it isn't just the Kyle family that are dying off at a rapid rate. It's like many of the people in the Osage community. So the Osage decide to send somebody to D.C. to try and lobby to Congress to send help. But that representative ends up disappearing and he never comes home. We get to find out that he's murdered, but the Osage community think he disappeared. And then Molly hires a private investigator to look into the murders. And he ends up disappearing because King ordered that he be scared off and beat up. So Molly then, as a last resort, despite being very ill with diabetes, decides to take it upon herself to go to Washington to request from the president himself to send help to Osage. So because of Molly making too much noise, as King kind of alluded to, King forces Ernest to start drugging Molly to slow her down. So it's basically making her so sick that she can't leave the house. And Ernest feels really bad about it, but he feels powerless to stop it. And out of shame, he starts to take the poison himself. And it's kind of sad, like you pity him. And what were you going to say?
No, you're good.
Oh, I was just going to say, like the whole time in the movie, the people behind us were just like adamantly saying over and over again, like, he's so stupid, as if it was annoying. And I was like, you are not getting the point of the movie. Like his stupidity is what made him such an interesting main character, because you always pity him like a child, even though he makes the mistake of an adult.
Yes.
And his stupidity is what leads the entire movie. Like his character is so in depth and like intense and like unfathomable, that's what made the movie so special, was that you don't understand him.
It doesn't make sense.
I know, like do you want him to be a smart guy, because then that this whole I mean, obviously in the real life story I wish he was a better guy, but like in the movie, like his character is what makes it so special.
Yeah, that's what makes the story.
Yeah. So
fun fact, like that was this was like the first case of the FBI. It had like just been created by J. Edgar Hoover.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Crazy. Wow. That's cool.
Did not know that.
They did a good job. They cracked the case, apparently.
Yeah. And also, Leonardo DiCaprio was first, he was going to be the FBI character, and the story was going to be about the investigation, like mostly, instead of it being about their relationship.
Oh, I like it way better about their relationship.
I know, right? It becomes like from Molly Burkhart's point of view instead of the FBI.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate that they did that, because that's the real point of view that mattered in the whole story.
Yeah. And like, I appreciate Scorsese going to like extreme lengths to get the like talking to Osage people, having actual Osage actors mm-hmm. in the movie and doing all the hard work beforehand.
Yeah.
So that it's more accurate. Very, very David Fincher of him.
That's what makes these movies so good is like, when they truly like dedicate so much to making it like accurate and good and perfect.
Yeah.
So King and Ernest organized the death of Rita, Molly's last living immediate relative. And they blow up her house in the middle of the night, which is just so brutal to me. Like, why would you blow up their home?
Might be a little extreme.
Yeah. It's so... Molly is just hysterical from the death, but she inherits all of her family's head rights. So all of the Kyle family money goes to Molly. And the Bureau of Investigation is sent by the federal government to investigate the murders. And it is led by Tom White and a whole group of investigators.
Only took like 40 people to die for it to...
I know, it's really sad. Yeah. And like a woman traveled to D.C. to like beg.
Yeah, literally.
After her whole family has died. It's so sad. So King cannot kill or scare off federal agents, because if you kill a federal agent, more are just going to show up. So they agents end up going to Molly's house and they find her ill, and they take her to the hospital and they start nurturing her back to health. At the same time, they arrest Ernest and King for the crimes, because it was pretty darn obvious who was doing it. So Sergeant White, or whatever you'd call him, Agent White, convinces Ernest to confess and be a witness against his Uncle King in a trial for many of the Osage murders. King's attorney, though, convinces Ernest through coercion to flip to King's side and to not testify. While in prison, Ernest and Molly's youngest child dies of whooping cough. And this is a big turning point for Ernest's character. And it's sad that this is what it took for him to change sides, because if you think about it, his family has been dying. Like, all of his by-law family members have been dying, and they've been going through the same trauma that he has, and it took him to fully experience it himself and lose his own child to realize, like, what am I doing? You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a good thought.
It was really sad. But so Ernest ends up flipping sides, and he decides that he wants to testify against his uncle under the promise that the federal agents won't charge him. And so they kind of really show you that all that Ernest actually wants out of this is to be with his family. Like, he just wants to go home. And so these decisions he's making at this point are like, what can I do to get out of this situation? Because I just want to go home. I just want to be with my family. Yeah. And I think that's all he ever really wanted, like, the whole time.
Yeah, I never doubted that he didn't, like, love Molly. You know?
Yeah, I think he really did. I think he just didn't know what he was doing. So after the trial, Molly meets Ernest and asks him to confess what he put in her shots. And he had thought that he was going to get away with everything, honestly. He had thought that he had cleared his conscience. She was there to talk to him after. And it's almost as if they portrayed it that she would almost have forgiven him for all that he had done, so long as he had never had intention to harm her and her family. And her learning that he had been injecting her was like the last straw.
Yeah, that scene, like, there's some scenes like in movies that just like go beyond acting. You know what I mean? That's one of those scenes.
It was.
It's just like, what?
It was really good. So they transition the movie then into a radio show where they're telling the story on a radio in like the 1950s-ish timeline.
That was an interesting choice. Interesting decision.
It was such a good decision because it is such a story that would be turned into a true crime story, you know? And then it was so genius. It was so cool. And it was fun to watch because they were doing all the different sound effects that they would do on like a radio show back then. They had a live orchestra to play the music.
Martin Scorsese himself.
Martin Scorsese like closed out the movie. It was just so good. And then they wrap it up by telling you that Ernest and King ended up going to jail, but they ended up getting out on parole. Molly divorced Ernest and remarried. And in the last scene, they show from overhead numerous Osage people celebrating their surviving culture in a large dance ceremony. So it's kind of goes to show, like, no matter what you did, no matter what you tried to take from them, they are still there. They still have their community, and they're still celebrating.
Agreed.
It was very beautiful, and it was a beautiful shot too.
Yeah, it really reminded me of Midsommar, and
yeah,
Scorsese said he looked at Midsommar and Beau Is Afraid on like how to pace this movie.
Really?
Yeah, he took
Midsommar. I agree with the pacing. Beau Is Afraid, I don't
see. I'm the opposite. Midsommar, I just sleep through that movie.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my god, Midsommar was great.
Really?
In the creepiest of ways. Yeah. So, any other fun facts?
So this is the seventh collaboration between Scorsese and DiCaprio.
Damn.
And the 11th between Scorsese and Robert De Niro, if you count The Audition, which is a short film, apparently.
So he picks favorites, is what you're saying?
Well, yeah, yeah. He's De Niro and him are like, if they're together, the movie's going to be a banger.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time Scorsese, De Niro, and DiCaprio have all collaborated together. And Scorsese's next movie is called The Wager.
He's already got it lined up.
Leonardo DiCaprio. It's about like a shipwreck in like the 1700s and like mutiny. And
oh my gosh, that's going to be fun.
I know, it's going to be so good.
So what do you want to do on the podcast next week?
So we got a couple options. We can do The Killer by David Fincher. What else is coming out? There's Anatomy of a Fall, which is playing at the State Theater, which won the big prize at the
Love Cannes Film Festival. You can pick whatever
you want. Okay, we'll do. I can't decide; it's too hard.
Just pick one. We'll do them all eventually.
That's true. We'll do The Killer by David Fincher.
Sounds good. Bye, guys.
Bye.